Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller and this is NPR News. This hour, did the Me Too movement change the face of Congress and why? It may have more to do with politics than gender. I'm going to throw some numbers at you this hour because they give us a lot of insight on how Me Too is influencing politics, like this. 116 women were elected on Tuesday, 42 of them women of color, and more women, 9, will run states as governors than ever before. Now, consider that as I toss a couple more numbers your way from an NPR Ipsos poll done in late October, 75% of Republicans, 21% of Democrats believe the Me Too movement has gone too far. More on that in a minute. Today, we're going to try to understand how politics shapes our perceptions about harassment and assault, and why some Americans believe the Me Too movement has gone, quote, too far, as was polled in the Ipsos NPR poll. As our guests help us guide the conversation, I want to hear what you have to say about this. 1 year into Me Too, how do you perceive the allegations that continue to emerge? And take a moment to think about this. Is your view shaped by your politics and political events like the Kavanaugh hearings? Did it shape the way you voted in the midterms? So I want to know, a year after Me Too emerged in full force, how you see some of the allegations that continue to emerge, how you see the political environment, and whether the way you're looking at this is influenced by the political views that you hold. This poll would seem to suggest that it is. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, as always, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Susan Chira is with us. She's the gender issues senior correspondent and editor at the New York Times, and she's with us from New York City. Susan, I know you've been doing a lot of traveling. Really nice to have you on the show again. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Is it true you were in Minnesota to do some work on this?
I was actually spent a lot of time in the Minneapolis area suburbs, congressional districts 2 and 3, the races that Angie Craig and Dean Phillips won. And I was talking to women to try to gauge, you know, this sort of much vaunted suburban defection from the Republican candidates in the midterms. So, yes, indeed.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to you on that in just a second. I'm curious about what you heard about the movement. Terry Vecchio is with us. She's a professor of psychology at Penn State and with us today from Atlanta, Georgia. And Terry, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be on the show.
So, Susan, when you were here in Minnesota and doing some of your traveling and you were trying to assess where suburban women were on the president and the culture at large, was Me Too coming up in those discussions?
Interestingly, it didn't. That was in Minnesota, it didn't. In Mississippi, it did, but I can tell you about that later. But in Minnesota, what came up was gun control and the environment, a lot of concern about President Trump's demeanor, behavior in office, to some extent misogyny, immigration policy, family separation. Those things seem to be at the top of the women I spoke to who were going to, who had voted Republican in the past for their local representative, you know, and were moving over on the local level, they also had some local issues that factored into their decision to vote against someone they had supported in the past.
Well, I have to say that what you're saying really matches with when I asked voters before and after the issues that were motivating them. They were saying what you heard. So then I'm
That's good.
Yeah. So then I'm curious. The environment is obviously a compelling issue in this part of the country. But then I'm curious about whether you think the Me Too has changed, whether there's an acknowledgement, I guess, of the way Me Too has changed the environment we're living in, even if it isn't a motivating voter issue.
Yeah,
you see what I'm asking.
If I may, I'm not sure I can generalize from those interviews because it definitely came up in other ways in other parts of the country. And, for example, when the New York Times sent out a reader call-out, in other words, after the Kavanaugh hearings, we asked for responses, and we got in excess of 50,000 replies. That's
wow.
one of the highest responses ever gotten from any request to readers we ever put out. And so, you know, I think it varies to some extent where you are. Interestingly, in Mississippi, where I was after President Trump had been at a rally at which he mocked Christine Blasey Ford, there were a lot of very visceral conservative responses from women about Me Too. And it was very much fit the pattern you probably heard about, where a number of the women were worried about their own husbands or sons or male relatives being falsely accused. They were skeptical of women's accounts. They didn't feel they should automatically believe women.
Mm-hmm.
And this held true even in the case of women who had experienced sexual assault or harassment themselves, who were conservative. And what I would say is I think is interesting, you raised this interesting question about whether it has to do with politics or whether it has to do with gender. But interestingly, in a lot of the polling and political science work that I reviewed in thinking about this, Republican women in general have suggested that gender equity, one, is not foremost in their political priorities
mm-hmm.
compared to Democratic women who rate it much more highly, but also that a segment of Republican women, particularly those of evangelical women, have, but extending beyond that, and particularly of those who are non-college educated, have more traditional beliefs about gender and about women's place,
mm-hmm.
which also seems to factor in how you think about Me Too.
It's really, really interesting. Terry, I want to grab a call for you from Megan in Minneapolis. Hey, Megan, hi. Glad you called.
Thanks. I've been really hoping to get to this point of the one-year mark of hashtag Me Too because I've been sort of trying on this this thought I've been thinking for several months now at dinner parties with friends, and
mm-hmm.
I'm almost a little afraid to say it over the radio because I'm not sure I've articulated it in the most perfect way yet, but I certainly don't think that women are at all to blame for all the things that we have learned in individual stories from hashtag Me Too, but I feel like the political dominance of men and then white men in our culture has allowed the hashtag, the Me Too movement and politics where they sort of come together in maybe a not useful way, is that we can stay really focused on blaming men, and there's so many examples to do so, and not yet sort of swung the conversation far enough over to like the preventative medicine of this problem and how we build skills in women, especially mothers and teachers of younger women and girls. And so it's politics are so combustive in our culture, especially now, that just I feel like it would be great at year mark to start changing all of our conversations, especially ones I hear on NPR, about, hey, women, what can we do to gain skills, prevent these things? Many of these things are not preventable, but at the same time, building skills to just even deal with them in the event that they continue to occur, because there's a long swing of getting that behavior corrected.
I think you've said that well, Megan, and I follow your logic there. You want to hear, and I think this is out there, but you know, when the loudest voices usually dominate these conversations. We haven't gotten to, I think, what you'd call the problem solving of this, right?
The preventative medicine. I have been saying to friends at dinner parties, let's let men be in the doghouse for a good year. And then let's start talking about how we solve those things. And one of the things that comes up a lot is, I mean, sexual harassment training, totally essential, yes. But at the same time, on a basic level for all other issues as well, assertiveness training and apology training. Because people are going to keep making these mistakes.
And yeah, I don't want
to
give men...
I need an apology and I can give an apology is part of the healing process, too.
Okay. I want to put this to Terry and Sousa and hear what they hear and what you've said. Terry?
I think it's important to focus on the correction. I completely agree. But I think we're still trying to get our head around what is going on with the disconnect between Democrats and Republicans. And I think it's a slightly more complicated picture than it might seem on first blush. So if we look back to your poll, you're absolutely correct. Republicans thought false allegations were a much bigger problem. 73% to the Democrats, 36%.
Which is mind-blowing.
Men were more... Yeah, it's a huge difference. Men are more afraid of being falsely accused. And I want to switch attention over here to women. And in my data from other sources, I would say predominantly white heterosexual women. 46% of Republicans are saying they're afraid some man in their life is going to be falsely accused. Now, we know that from what you said, but the irony that I think also exists is when you look at beliefs on this poll about whether or not people, those who are accused, should get the benefit of the doubt, there's also a huge political split,
right,
with Republicans saying that accused men should get the benefit of the doubt 67% of the time, only 67% of the time, and Democrats saying 85% of the time. And so there's something very interesting going on in terms of the gender assumptions, the gender stereotypes underlying these beliefs. And so I think we have to think about it not just in terms of, I think Susan pointed this out, you know, the gender beliefs underlying this, but maybe we need to focus a little bit more on masculinity and what we expect of men and what we think, how we think men should behave and what we expect, because both Republican and Democratic women will say equality is important, even if they prioritize it at different levels. Yes, Democratic women will put it higher on their list of values, but it's not that it's not important to Republican women. It's just lower in importance. But what may really be important here is what we define as a good man and what we believe is good male behavior. And so I want to point that out in some part, like to the degree that we think men should be powerful, strong, tough, and nothing like women.
Perceptions of masculinity, yes.
As being central to this problem. And so before we go to the fix, I need to understand a little bit more about what's underlying the problem, because it's more than just an apology that's needed. If the problem is how we're construing masculinity and how we're raising our sons and how we're interacting with the men we choose to love and share our lives with, it's a different issue than simply taking responsibility and apologizing.
Susan, I took note of something that Clara Wilkins at Washington University told NPR about the poll. She said, when there's a conflict between gender and party, party wins. That's what's going to drive people's attitudes. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's what political scientists have found forever. That's a very consistent finding. Party trumps gender. Party that this whole idea that somehow women will have a shared perspective and because of certain universal life experiences that are unique to women, but that doesn't translate into gender solidarity or, you know, in a political switch of parties. So that's one of the great truisms of political science. And I do think that the issue of masculinity is so crucial because I think one of the issues is, you know, to what extent when you talk about how boys are thought also to perform sexually and to sort of date or I think the question is that society has often portrayed both through pornography and through mainstream kinds of social pressures that, you know, men are often given subtle cues about, well, women don't really mean no, you know, culturally. I don't mean in the training they get in colleges or what's said to them overtly, but I think the messages that they've been getting and the cultural rewards for dominance and strength and aggression and what makes you seem like a real man, you know, still skew in ways that I think need to be still thought through and addressed.
This is Peggy Ornstein's new book, I think, is going to be about this. I've read a lot of her, the interviews that she's doing with boys about this. I mean, this is that contradiction. I think I heard you saying this, Terry. By the way, that a lot of women are invested in what, as you said, what we think it means to be a man, to be male in the culture. And that, I think, collides sometimes with expectations about sexual harassment, and that's coming out in this movement. We're wrangling with that, aren't we?
We're definitely wrangling with that, and I think political scientists have really thought about, as Susan points out, is it gender or political party? And we often don't think about the interactions between those two. There is no doubt that women's experiences are not shared across the divide. Susan's absolutely right.
Right.
But what may be shared across the divide is a cultural understanding of what a good man is, or at least what the ideal is. And we might share that idea of what is a good man more like a cultural ideology than anything else. And we can be aware of that if we're Democrats or if we're Republicans, and that can explain away and justify a lot of different sorts of behaviors. And then the more you expect this and accept it into your own life, the more you might be worried men in your life will be accused of this.
Terry Vecchio with us, if you've just tuned in, from Penn State, and Susan Shira with us, senior correspondent and editor at the New York Times. We're talking about a poll that came out last week from NPR and Ipsos measuring Americans' reactions to the Me Too movement 1 year in, how our perceptions about the movement are being guided by politics. Really interesting revelations here. And I'd like to hear from you this morning about how you perceive the allegations that continue to emerge. And when you take stock of your own political views, do you find that they may be influencing the way you see the movement? Did it shape the way you voted in the midterms? What do you think about it now? Back to our conversation this hour, Susan Shira from The New York Times, Terry Vecchio from Penn State, and to Jenny in St. Paul. Jenny, thanks so much for waiting. I'm really glad you did, and I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, thanks. I'm calling because I think the Me Too movement is like really a delayed response to everything that's always been going on.
Long time coming.
Men have been attacking and harassing women for a long time, and it's always incumbent upon the woman to stop this. Where the Me Too movement hasn't gone far enough, you can tell from the caller that called in and said, let's talk about action steps. And her action steps were, women should take classes.
Assertiveness training.
Women.
Yeah.
Men are the attackers. Men are the ones that need to change. And if anything, women need to teach their men children, you know, how to treat women and, you know, hands are not for hitting and all those kind of things.
What do you hear in that, Terry?
I think Jenny's absolutely right that all too often when we talk about discrimination on any grounds, race, gender, sexual orientation, we turn to the people that are targets of the unequal treatment and talk about what we need to do to protect our self-esteem, to communicate more clearly. This is particularly true in the case of sexual harassment. The focus of attention needs to shift back to men and the men who consider themselves allies. We have a big Democratic-Republican split in how people perceive the issue, and we can talk to men about what they can do to intervene when they see it, not in a paternalistic way, but to intervene when they see it, how to think about choices for candidates, how to talk about if you choose supporting a candidate who has a history of doing this, what does that mean for the lives of those of us to whom it's done to? Right now, there's a split where privileged people it does not happen to get to decide how much they prioritize our rights and our freedoms and our right to be not discriminated against, not harassed, and the rest of us have to live with those decisions. But a true ally stands with those people they love and value. And we can do a lot educating people about the consequences of their actions, inactions, political support, and what it truly means to be a coalition and an ally.
Terry, I wonder what you make of one of the findings in this poll that, again, I think we've covered the fact that there's a lot of contradiction and some ambivalence here among Americans about it. But this stood out to me. 69% of the people surveyed in the poll say the Me Too movement has created a climate in which harassers and other offenders will be held accountable. But then you have all these other numbers. So that's a positive outcome. And there's a lot of agreement that seemed to supersede party. But then you have all these other numbers that say, and yet there's all these false accusations. I mean, is that just we are upsetting a power structure, you know, to some of what people are tweeting about? We're upsetting a power structure here, and it's uncomfortable, and it comes right at, you know, some mythologies that we hold pretty dear. I mean, is that what's why we see these contradictions?
I think there's two levels. I think we see that contradiction whenever we see a chance of upsetting the power structure. And I think that at the macro level, that's a completely accurate prediction of when we would see this kind of response.
Okay.
At the psychological level, I think that people aren't fancying themselves jerks that want to have power over or protect their position. I think at the psychological level, what may be a better explanation is that groups differ in terms of how we think about, let's just say prejudice, you know, whether it's toward whatever group. And to the degree that we think prejudice, racism, and discrimination and harassment are things that happen from people with a bad heart who want to do this, then we get a lot of defensiveness and a lot of fear of false allegations, I would suspect. But to the degree that we think that we're raised in a racist, sexist society, we have internalized norms and courtship rituals that really reinforce male dominance and women's female submission, to the degree that we take the intent out of it, we are less reactive. And part of what we may be seeing here is the realization that everybody did become more aware. The 69% are more aware of the problem and better able to define it. But then there's a lot of differences in how much people fear that coming back to haunt them because of their understanding of what causes prejudice. If you really think we internalize it and good people can do these things, you deal with it in a far different way than if being accused of being prejudiced and discrimination, it makes you an evil person.
Susan, just a quick note here. I'm hearing from some friends on Twitter who are reminding me that Tarana Burke is the one who named this Me Too, and that was primarily about sexual assault, and she's been working on this for a long time. And yes, I understand that, and I know that. Perhaps I should say, when the New York Times broke these stories, and I guess it entered a wider American consciousness, I don't know, how would you put it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's very, very important to credit that Tarana Burke gave it the name and had been working for years. I think it broke into wider public consciousness, and I think, you know, one of the points that I'm sure people on Twitter are making is that, you know, one of the sad parts about that is that, let's face it, you know, women of color and working class women and women who were not prominent actresses, you know, everyday women, if you will, have been enduring this kind of sexual assault and grievous sexual harassment, you know, for decades. And even the great, the sort of path-breaking legal cases about sexual harassment, a lot of them in the late 70s and 80s, as this began moving into the courts, or actually mid to late 80s, they were in factory settings with largely blue-collar women. So, yes, I think that's a really important point to make, but I think that a lot of these movements take time to gain consciousness. And Tarana Burke had been, you know, working nobly to call attention to this, but I do think it kind of consumed the society and the world in a much broader way.
Call here from Tressa in St. Paul. Hi, Tressa.
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for doing this show. I'm a public opinion researcher. I live in St. Paul, but actually based out of Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And we from Periundum, and we did a survey recently for Plan International among boys and girls, mm-hmm. adolescents, national survey. And just to underscore the discussion about the problem, we did find this was a really comprehensive survey that 7 in 10 boys feel pressure from parents, teachers, society to be physically strong. These societal norms and pressures around strength and aggressiveness, 44% feel pressure to be willing to throw a punch if they're provoked. A third feels pressure to dominate or be in charge of others. So there's definitely boys are still facing and internalizing those pressures. I think Susan also mentioned, you know, sort of the sexual, boys are more likely to feel pressure around sex and hooking up with a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And Susan mentioned online porn, 79% of boys 14 to 19 have seen online porn. And that's correlated with views, egalitarian views. That's correlated. The more frequent boys see online porn, the less likely they are to want equal numbers of men and women in positions of power.
I'm glad you explained that, Tressa, because we might have listeners saying, what does seeing online porn have anything to do with the way we see gender equality? Because online porn reinforces a model of dominance, right? And submission, often.
That's right. And what's interesting in our data is, so that's one of the top correlates with disagreeing that I want equal numbers of men and women in office. You know, and another correlate is having a Republican parent. So I think, as others have said on the, Susan Terry have said on the show, the partisanship, even filters down to kids. So having a Republican parent, you're more likely to say, I don't want equal numbers of men and women who are leaders in work. And I do work on this issue all the time with voters. And, you know, between Republicans and Democrats, and I think polling sometimes is just one dimensional. So you get the same percent with contradictory where you really understand the differences is in qualitative. But that there's a whole Republicans see perceived sexism and inequality in a vastly different way than Democrats.
Yeah, that so comes out in this Ipsos poll, Tressa.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep, exactly. So it's not that everybody sees the same problem.
Right.
They see the problem differently.
Right. So, Susan, I think, Tressa, I'm so glad you called, and I think we need to talk to you more often. I didn't know you were living in our midst, so I hope to hear more about the work that you do. Susan, I would also say that I don't think the parents of, you know, the people that are being polled would say, sure, I want to raise my son, not, you know, respecting women and not being in a culture where there's equality. I mean, this is so much more subtle and multifaceted than I think often we talk about this in such a simplified way.
I think that's so important. I thought, you know, Terry and Tress are both making these points really well. The point that Terry made, I think, is very important. You know, how do you solve this if you label anyone who does this as a completely evil person? You know, you're going to polarize people, much the way the discussion about race is often polarized. And I think that, you know, parents often say they want their children, their sons, to respect women. I think what the subtlety partly is, you know, how that comes into conflict with you know, what dating behavior is and what the difference between perhaps being a boyfriend or husband that you can rely on to advocate for you and protect you in a way that anyone would want from a partner. And when that spills over into rewarding of dominance and of not listening to women and of not heeding signals and of not understanding, you know, the whole issue about the gray areas in sex, you know, one of the great conversations that we haven't had enough is, you know, sex is very messy and complex, and the signals that are sent and training people to think about how is it that so many sexual experiences are so awful for boys and girls
That's
and men
right.
and women.
That's right.
You know, and so part of this is to be much clearer about consent and to be much clearer about understanding unstated signals and to understand that, you know, you can still think of yourself as a person who wants to respect women and make a woman in a sexual situation or a work environment deeply uncomfortable and feel harassed. So there's so much education to do, and I also think, though, to return to a point that a caller made earlier, I certainly agree with Terry that there are deeper issues to be excavated, but I also agree that we haven't really figured out the sort of unrepentiveness and unreflectiveness of a lot of men who have been accused of sexual harassment also strikes me to be an important
issue. That's a whole nother show, Susan. That just drives me crazy. Susan, I'm always intrigued with what you're writing and reporting on. Thanks so much for the time, and I look forward to your next writing in the Times. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on
the show. Terry, such a pleasure to have you. I hope you'll come back because there's so much more to talk about here.
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure.
Good.
Minnesota's my home, so
oh,
it's a pleasure to talk
that.
To you anytime.
Great.
I'm a Minnesota kid.
We'll take you up on that. Thank you so much, Terry.
Thank you.
I also want to note for listeners who are interested in these issues, we have a forum, an NPR News forum planned in early January about masculinity, these perceptions of what it means to be a man. And one of my favorite guests, you hear him somewhat often, Jose Santos, is going to be in the forum. We'll give you details and times. It's a free forum, but a good conversation coming up in early January.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.